Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands. I wanted to give a little heads up on this particular episode with Paul Coffey. We had some technical difficulties and there was some audio that I was not able to fix up. I believe it's around minute 48. So just bear in mind that we had a little glitch, but the episode came out pretty good and I hope you enjoy. Thank you. Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts, typically with a focus on Kenpo. As always, I am your host, Reggie Darden, and I have another wonderful guest with me today, Mr. Paul Coffey, and we're going to get into his journey as a martial artist and also as a fellow podcaster. So we'll just talk about his journey and his show, and whatever other items that we decide to get onto, we'll talk about that as well. So I usually kick things off with just a little bit of my background. For the listeners that have heard this for the millionth time, here it is again. But I currently train in multiple martial arts, Kenpo, American Kenpo being the primary one, or I guess one of the primary ones. I also train in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai, Hapkido, Capoeira, and I have some experience in boxing and in Taekwondo. And I just love the martial arts and love having a guest on the show to talk martial arts and all other nerdy geeky things that come to mind. So that's my little background there. But we will turn it over to our guest, Mr. Coffey. So we just go with we'll take it back to the beginning. Where did it all start for you? Where did the your martial arts journey begin? And we'll just kind of go from there.
Okay, that sounds good. Hello, everyone. I'm Paul Coffey. My base is also in Shaolin Kenpo. However, I've studied several other things, kind of studying out and then returning back to base as one does as a martial artist. I was an abused child, and I went through about an entire year of physical abuse until it became sexual abuse, and that at 10 years old decided I could not take it any longer. So I had a friend who joined a local Fred Villari Shaolin Kenpo school, and I begged and begged and begged for my parents to let me go. My parents had no idea what was going on, but they were receptive to it. They thought that the reason I joined was because of my love of Batman, which also was a thing. But I started Shaolin Kenpo when I was 10 years old, and when I reached black belt at around, I think I was 16, the school that I was studying in requested that you study another art before you get your second degree black belt. So being 16, not having a reliable car, I had to go with Tai Chi because that was the only other thing that was offered in school. And I also got black sash and Tai Chi during that process. But I've since branched out. I've done a plethora of things. Wing Chun, obviously Tai Chi. I'm currently looking at Irish stick fighting, and I'm currently looking at Bagua. So that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, like me, very, very busy. stay very yes. Busy. I just wanted to make sure that I was clear. So going back, so when you started, did the situation with the abuse come to light, or was that still unknown at that time?
the situation with the abuse. My parents, my family didn't find out till I was about 22 years old. And my uncle, who was the one responsible for the abuse, he was dead by then, long dead. He committed suicide when I was 17 or 18. So, no, that abuse didn't come to light. When I'd studied martial arts for about a year, around a year, I had gotten my green belt in Kenpo, and he came to attack me one time in the bathroom, and I defended myself, you know, just gut reflex, grab the arm, turn, and throw. He hit the wall twice and hit the floor once and split himself open and had to go to the hospital and get stitches. He had said that he didn't know what happened and thought that he just fell because he was drunk, but he never tried to put hands on me ever again. So when I was 11, that did end. When the physical abuse ended, there was a lot of still mental or emotional abuse via verbal that carried on until he died. When he committed suicide, the first time that he tried to commit it, he just got real drunk and drove very fast into a tree. And that didn't work for him. He was in an upper body cast and his jaw was wired shut. And for the month that his jaw was wired shut, I took care of him. I was the one that fed him. And then when he got out of that cast, he committed suicide successfully the second time. So it ended, you know, and I did end up airing my grievances and telling my parents and, you know, having those tougher conversations. And I'm currently writing a book about it, apparently, because that's what it, you know, as nature or God or whatever higher calling you choose to believe in calls you to do things, you do them. So I'm answering that call from the muse currently.
Yeah, no, whatever, anything that helps with the healing process, the growth process, is definitely important. And mm-hmm. I think it's important to be able to share those stories. It's, you know, it's a very tough conversation to have, and definitely something that is, it's hard to put those things out there. It just mm-hmm. even kind of going, there's always that kind of thought of, oh, well, this is it's always the creepy neighbor down the street or something like that. Mm-hmm. And when it's your own, so it's hard to talk about it even in just that context. But then when it's your own family and it's mm-hmm. a repeated situation, that makes it even more difficult to bring those things out. But those things mm-hmm. definitely need to go out, especially for those people that maybe don't have an outlet for to get that information out. Or, you know, maybe there are people out there that are getting abused and they don't know what to do, and or mm-hmm. and they don't feel that they have any kind of situation to explain and tell their story. So I think it's mm-hmm. important for people that have been in that situation to share that. And
yeah,
and let people know that, you know, hey, this is something that's going on, and then these are the things that you can do to get out of it and mm-hmm. Not be alone. So I try and kind of make my episodes kind of sort of evergreen, but mm-hmm. I will kind of bring up something, a situation that I've been privy to as of recent. So mm-hmm. I made a post on this on my page, but the actor Ray Park, best mm-hmm. known for playing Darth Maul in the Star Wars movies, had been making a lot of, in my opinion, concerning kind of posts that make make me kind of question his mental state, I guess, situation with his significant other, wife, girlfriend. I'm not sure, but just making a lot of kind of crazy posts and just going on and, you know, really airing out his dirty laundry, so to speak. But it just kind of made me think that people are going through, you can be going through things and feel like you're all alone or no one understands, and there is help available. There's friends, there's mm-hmm. family members, there's mm-hmm. there's people in the dojo and stuff that can mm-hmm. that you can go to. And I really want people to understand that there is a shoulder to cry on, an ear to listen to, and it doesn't always, it's not a situation where we have to be just by ourselves and dealing with this situation by ourselves. So swinging it more back to the martial arts side of mm-hmm. it, that is a big help for the martial arts, and another reason not to just, you know, learn how to snap somebody's arm or anything like that, but right. to connect with other people and have that connection and have someone else to be able to help you get through just not only the physical things, but the emotional things as well. So, mm-hmm. I'm kind of got off on a little bit of a tangent there, but kind of connecting back with the early mm-hmm. the early training. That is something I would assume that being in the training also helped you mentally and emotionally mm-hmm. to. You know, deal with what's going on and progress further.
Mm-hmm. Now, absolutely. The thing is that I always talk about my journey being unique in that it was first out of desperation that I came to martial art. I needed something to stop. I knew that it couldn't continue. And then, you know, at green belt, I got to a point to where, oh, maybe it isn't continuing, you know? And I didn't really put it to rest that the abuse was over until he tried to kill himself the first time. But at that point in time, I had started in the school that I was a part of, they had an instructor pathways program. And so I was already on the first step, which was just a team leader. I would, you know, I'm somebody that you could ask questions to. I would also like start warm-ups and stretches and just the beginning of class, sometimes even the punches and kicks. But that's where I was in the martial part of my journey. And when he laid to rest, it was like, oh, this helped me conquer a physical demon. Can it help me help other people do the same thing? So then my journey for years became about teaching and cultivating individuals so that if they were in those situations, they could, you know, stand up to abusers or oppressors and fight that own injustice. But then the intertwining energy that exists in martial arts and in the way that things string together for us, it then became about, oh, there's a lot of demons that I have inside me that were passed on from my uncle that I need to deal with. And so then it became a how do I heal? How do I grow? And then it's sort of an ebb and flow. Heal and grow, teach some more, heal and grow, teach some more. But all of us that teach martial arts, we know in part we teach martial arts selfishly so that we can learn in some capacity from our students by sharing those perspectives. And I think the whole time was growth for me, and I just maybe wasn't aware of it or open to it. So,
gotcha. Now, going back again, how did you find that particular school, or what was the thing that got you training at that particular school, that first school?
There's a lot of things that like go back into it. You know, I'd always kind of had a privy to martial arts. I got into comic books when I was 7 years old. My grandfather, he took me to a comic book store, and I got one of every issue that was on the wall for all the main titles, and then two titles that he really liked, and brought them home, and he had me read them. And after I read them, the idea was, I'll pick the one that I like, and he'll help me start a little comic book collection. Gravitated towards Batman. I haven't looked back. I know this is an audio podcast, but I got a Batman shirt on. I got a Batman tattoo. Everything's Batman.
Very nice.
Batman was always like a privy to martial arts. Like, I considered him so strong of a character because of the dedication that he gave to martial art. And I thought, like, yeah, you know, no matter what, that's there. And so I'd always like kind of been like looking around and like asking people, and you're in elementary school, hey, do you know karate? Hey, do you know karate? And nobody really did. And then my friend who lived on the same block as me, his grandmother happened to take him to karate literally like, you know, weeks before the troubling incident happened. And like he came and he had his like fancy new white gi and everything, and I'm like, that's so awesome. And so I had that initial moment of envy, and then I had the really, really tough situation. And at the moment that the really, really tough situation happened, immediately I was like, this has to stop. And then the next thought was, call Ben and see where his school is and see if I can figure out how to get involved in that. And that became a parents going, maybe. My grandfather said, if you collect enough cans that you have enough money for your first month, I'll pay for the rest of the first year. And he goes, but you have to commit for the entire year to do it. And then if you're still interested, we'll have a conversation about what to do going forward. And I was like, you know, you're 10 years old. You're like, a year's a really long time.
Oh, yeah.
A year's a really long time. But then you're like, I think Batman did it longer than a year. I can do a year, you know? So I collected cans. It took me about 3 weeks to collect enough cans for, I'm going to show my age, what was $60 a month was how much dues were. So back in 1993.
No, that was the same time that I officially formally started. So yeah, that sounds about right. And I believe my tuition was $60 a month as well. So yeah,
that's $60 a month. And that first month came with a free uniform. So
nice. So being a young person, did you really kind of take to the training? Did you have kind of any moments where it's like, oh, okay, this isn't really my thing? As kids tend to do, they tend to bounce around to different things, or were you just all in?
It was different for me. I recognized that I was different because I was there out of desperation. I didn't bounce around. I was there. And from the time that I was 10 to the time that I was 11, I was in every class I could possibly take. So 3 to 4 times a week, as much as I could get my parents to take me out there, or my grandfather, or whoever was going to take me out there, ride with Ben, whatever, get to the dojo, take the class. The reason that I started the instructor's pathways is because they said you could be in the school more. because you could lead some of the classes that you're not taking. You can be in the school more because teachers also help clean the school. Teachers also help, you know, fold the shirts and stock things up and help run the desk a little bit. And I was like, sign me up. And so then from the time I was 11 to freshman of high school, I was there almost every hour that I'm not in school. You know, I was dedicated in a different way, because first it was out of necessity. I had to make this bad situation stop. And then as soon as I made this bad situation stop, I felt that I owed something to martial arts. You know, I've been doing martial arts for 32 years, and I can say without hesitation, martial arts will give us more than we can ever give back to martial arts, which is one of the main reasons that I started my podcast. Is like, man, if I can enrich the community, if I can spread knowledge, if I can in some way preserve words of wisdom from other instructors, other masters, other students, then that's worth its weight in gold. And I can never repay the debt that I owe to martial arts for helping me, for saving my life, for saving my life multiple times over in the mental struggles that exist from being an abused victim. So I was the opposite of Ben, whom made it 6 months and then dropped out and went on to something else. And I saw a bunch of people come and go within the martial arts community. There is one guy whose name is also Ben, a different Ben, who started martial arts when I did, who I can say still takes martial arts to this day. So he's still got his 32 years and a little bit different trajectory for him, but like, I don't know of anybody else that is that way. So
yeah, that I can certainly relate to that. Well, can relate to a couple of things that you mentioned. One, being at the dojo all the time, or being at the studio all the time. And even before I officially signed up, I was there at the studio every day, getting out of school, and head down to the studio right before they opened, right when they opened, and I was there until they closed, and watching every classes. And then once I could sign up, then I was there nonstop. So I can definitely relate to that lifestyle. Then the other point that you mentioned is many of my guests, it's kind of funny to me in that many of my guests have made their martial arts their life, and yet many of them either didn't want to go, or they just happened to go because a friend brought them, or one of my guests believe he was just escorting a lady to a class, and the instructor drug him into the class, and then she stopped coming, and he made it his career and his life. And so it's always funny to me that it's always the friend that sticks around, and and not the initial target is the one that sticks right around. So
I think the message is what it is, and it's whoever needs it, it's going to get to, you know. And martial art being something that's been around for as long as it's been around, and it's interesting because it's mostly passed down verbally, you know. Like, yeah, there's martial arts books. Yeah, right now in this age we have YouTube and instructional videos and all this and the other. But if you look at the whole history and you take the whole history in totality, it's all written and word and taught. So it's all passed down in these folklore styles. And I think that that's important, because a folklore gets to you through somebody else who's like, yeah, I heard this funny little story, and tells the funny little story. And then you're like, wait, that really resonates with me. Who wrote that? And then you're down the rabbit hole. And martial arts to me has always appeared to be like a physical folk story.
So. Yeah. So going back to the teaching side of it, now is the teaching part of it something that you always long to do?
True. You know, that's a tougher question. I recently went on a trip to Keene, New Hampshire to Marshall Summit. If you and your listeners, anybody that's a fan of martial arts does not know what Whistle Kick is, you can look it up. They have a podcast with Whistle Kick Radio. They also have a bunch of other things. One of the things that they do is a thing called Martial Summit that they do every year. This was the first year I heard about it. I was invited. I made the trek, 13 and a half hour drive up to Keene, New Hampshire. It was worth it. I'm already there next year. It's in the calendar. It's my time off has been submitted at work. It is already happening next year. And I'm telling you that because in my tenure as an instructor, a lot has happened. I've taught within schools. In 2010, I started my own martial arts school. And then in 2012, I converted that to a nonprofit. In 2020, the nonprofit kind of took a couple of hits and closed to where the nonprofit still runs. And since 2020, I've been generating some income that I turn into scholarships. And I take those scholarships and I let a couple of kids that are disenfranchised who can't afford martial arts, it sort of pays their way into other schools that are around my town of Louisville, Kentucky. But in 2012, the teaching side of things, I brought all my students together and I said, I got good news, I got bad news. The bad news is that I'm not teaching martial arts any longer. And then I said that the good news is that instead of martial arts, I am teaching philosophy and motion. And you can still take martial arts from me if that is what your philosophy is. But the reason that I did that fundamentally is I was trying to foster an environment where students could learn longer from an individual. I don't think that everybody is lifelong practitioners of martial arts. And I don't think that people are going to stick around for 5 or 10 years even. But seeing people go to black belt and then drop, or to second degree and then drop, kind of like that was the genesis for like, hey, can we change this? And the idea is a student comes to you and they're like, I need self-defense. You know, like a student like me, I need self-defense. I need that. I got this bad situation and I need to get out of it. Well, point that I reached at 11, they're like, whew, sigh of relief. I'm out of it. I'm fine. And your mind thinks I survived that, so I can survive anything up until this point, so I don't need to do any more. And for some reason, that's not what my mind thought. My mind immediately went to, I could maybe help other people. I still have a lot to learn myself. And so it kind of kept that mentality for me. So that happened in 2012. And then somewhere along the way, probably like 2015-ish, I picked up this moniker where I would say, I am the worst martial arts instructor that you could ever have. But I am the best damn student you can have in class with you. And that was the moniker that I used up until Marshall Summit. Also, fully aware, been doing martial arts for 32 years. I'm 42 years old currently. And that I am still at 42 dealing with and healing from abuse. Very much aware of that. Very much conscious of that the whole journey. But up in Marshall Summit, I was saying, you know, my little moniker, I'm not a very good teacher, but I'm the best student, blah, 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 blah. And I taught 4 different classes. At the end of the third day, one of the guys who was also there to teach, who took one of my classes, he waited until the end of the day, and he's waiting in the lobby for me, and he goes, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And he goes, I think that you should drop that whole I'm a bad teacher thing. And it broke me down, you know, because I was like, that's a guy who's been doing martial arts like 40 years, you know, and like in the martial arts community, you get to a certain level. I haven't said rank specifically for reason, but you get to a certain level. You've been doing it so long and bouncing back and forth and stuff. Like you yourself have been doing it for 32 years, same as me. So that tells me more than what I need to know by you saying fancy ranks and belts. But this guy's been doing it 40 years. I had another guy who'd been doing it almost 50 years, and they're giving me compliments about my instruction. And like, it's like, oh, my peers are complimenting me, not students. You know, because it's like a kid that has done 6 months of martial arts, it's easy for me to come in and show him something that's going to blow his mind. It is easy. It's effortless because I've been doing it that long. But to have somebody that is 40 years ago, that's interesting. That's new. I like that. And it just kind of gave me a different perspective. And so when I taught my last class for Marshall Summit on Saturday, I picked up the moniker, I am a good martial arts instructor because I am the best student in class. And so like that, it changed a lot of me and a lot of what was going on. I mean, to the point that, you know, I've been back home for 3 weeks and I'm looking at locations for potentially opening schools, you know, so we'll see what happens.
Very nice. Yeah, I think that's well said. Well, okay, so I try and stay away from controversy, but here we go.
I appreciate you, but I don't do that.
Well, I say that because of I'm not a fan of the term master, grandmaster, that sort of thing. And no. You know, no. Internet, you can come after me. I'll you know, you have my address, but I don't like it because I feel that it's impossible to master a art, a system in any one lifetime. There's so For many sure. things. There's so many things that you learn and you grow and you evolve. And just looking at it from the perspective of American Kenpo, there's 154 base techniques, and then you have your extensions and all that. And okay, so once you've learned that, you quote unquote have learned the system, but you can't master it. And so I say that in the school that I train at, my instructor has an exercise that he throws at us sometimes, and he's like, you know, take the very first technique, delayed sword. You know, how many things can you build off of that technique? And we usually, oh yeah, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, you know, something like that. And it's like, no, there's infinite amount of techniques that you can, that defenses and things that you can build and work off of using the principles of Kenpo. There's infinite amount of things that you can build off of just that one technique, and you know, that's just one of 154 techniques. So to me, the thought that I could quote unquote master Kenpo is ludicrous to me. And so
I'll say that I most of my students call me sensei, which is, first of all, very unique for a Kenpo practitioner to be going by sensei, because Kenpo is Chinese, so I should be Sifu, right? Well, I've done equal parts of Japanese and Chinese arts, so I should get to pick. So I picked sensei mainly because it just means the one that came before, you know? It doesn't mean that I'm master or that I'm over somebody in any capacity other than my gung fu, my time on task, you know. I like using the term of sensei and goksei. Goksei means student. And then I also like using gung fu as the proper term because, gung fu means good hard work. So anybody can have gung fu, my next door neighbor has a lot landscaping business and he has really good gung fu in that capacity, But I think that it levels the playing field and it doesn't create a master, Same as you. But I will also add that very, very recently, I got to a point to where it's like, yeah, but the same way I'm mainly a Kenpo guy calling myself sensei, they have the right to be called master if they want to. Like, it's fine. It's all vernacular. It shouldn't catch us up. So.
No, I certainly don't have a, I'm not saying that nobody should use these terms or
Sure.
anything like that.
Sure.
Just for me personally, I prefer not to use those. And if someone feels that they need to be called that or prefer to be called that, then I have no problem with that. But just for my
Right.
own personal thing, those particular terms don't really, I don't think are really fitting or
For
appropriate.
sure.
But one of the thing that really popped for me that you said is that you're a teacher or you can be a good teacher because you're a really good student. And that I think that is to be a quote unquote master, you have to be a really good student. You have to always be thirsting for that knowledge and wanting to learn more and wanting to explore more and wanting to get more. Just the what's in the book, what's in the book should never be enough. And I believe so I've checked out some episodes of your show and hopefully I'm remembering correctly, but I believe it may have been you or somebody. I heard somebody on your show say something about always asking why. Always why is always the question. We're doing this thing, why? Okay, well, we're doing it because of this reason. Well, why is that reason a thing? And always continuing to ask why. And I think as a martial artist, you're doing yourself a disservice if you're not always why. You're not always trying to learn more, trying to gain more knowledge. If you ever feel that you've gotten to a point where it's like, okay, I know it, I understand it, everything, then no, you're not done. You're not there. You're not at the end. So yeah, always being that student is important to me, and I think is an important part to being a martial artist.
I had an instructor who would say, if you think that you've got it all, you're not even at the beginning yet.
Exactly.
And I think that probably beautifully sums it up. And then why? I think as a martial artist, the two things that we should always lead with are why and how. With the excitement and curiosity that exists of a child, in Tai Chi and in Kung Fu, we use the term, the term's irrelevant, but it means infant-like, And everything that we do from even a physical perspective should be infant-like. There's a childlike wonder that exists. So if you've been a martial artist for a lifetime, and that lifetime is 5 years, is 10 years, is 32 years, is 50 years, you've been somewhere that where martial arts is taking place, and you've saw something, you're going, wow, that's cool. How in the world did that happen? How in the world did he do that throw? How in the world did he place his hands? Whatever it is, that childlike wonder is how you should meet every new technique. How are you doing that? Because it makes you absorb it in a different way. It makes you absorb it in a positive way, but it also makes you want it, viscerally want it, And then the things that don't make sense are the whys. I talk a lot about, we're martial artists, we quote Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee said, take what is available, discard what is useless. And I think that quote is the most misused quote in all of martial arts. Because I respectfully don't think, and there's no way to know, we can't ask him. I don't think that what he meant by that is this kick's not working for me, get rid of it. I think what he's meaning is you discard what's useless, which is that kick doesn't work. You ask why it's useless. Why am I supposed to use this? How do I use this? And then when you learn the right way, it is no longer useless. So I think he was saying not to discard the techniques, that the techniques work, but discard the ego so that it gets out of the way so that the technique can be, you know, understood, digested, so that the technique can divulge itself. I had another martial arts master who said that martial arts already exists. Your goal is to try and tune your body to the frequency of martial arts so that you can be a perfect receptor of it. Maybe.
Yeah. No, I don't believe I said this in the beginning. And this is something I usually say, but I don't say that when we're talking about you're getting your start in martial arts, it's not that you chose martial arts, but martial arts chose you. And mm-hmm. connecting in with these people that didn't decide to make martial arts their life at the start. Well, mm-hmm. martial arts chose them to make that their career, make that their life. And the people that stopped training or maybe trained and then stopped and then came back, it's not because they chose it. It's because that art, that system, that philosophy, whatever you want to call it, chose them and said, okay, you need to be this person that is going to progress the art or come up with whatever new system or whatever however it manifests itself. It's because that mm-hmm. the art, the spirits, the whatever you want to call it, decided that that person needs to be the vessel for that. So
absolutely.
So let's talk about your show. You have the Keep Kicking podcast. So mm-hmm. Much like me, you talk to martial artists and why did the show start? So for those that don't know, podcasting is it's a bit more work than it might seem. So what thrusted you into doing this labor of love that that is podcasting?
That's a big question. I have worked in film. I did a documentary. I was a producer and interviewer on a documentary for a cemetery that is in Louisville, Kentucky, Eastern Cemetery. It's the most grossly abused cemetery in the nation. That is a statement that I have made. That is not a statement that any historian has made. I have done my due diligence. And if anybody would like to prove me wrong, I would love to have the conversation with you. You can reach out to me. So I did that, and I really enjoyed sitting and interviewing with people. And I found that I was really good at that because it's an extension of teaching martial arts, you know, which I started when I was 11. I don't claim to have taught martial arts since I was 11. I've taught since I was about 14. Because 14 was when I had graduated through that program and was able to teach my whole first class. They only gave me white belts and yellow belts, but I was teaching a whole class of white belts and yellow belts at 14. So I've been teaching martial arts for 28 years. But in part, it was, hey, I enjoyed interviewing. And like at the point in time, it was kind of a lull in martial arts. And it was like, well, maybe if I don't do martial arts, I'd do something interviewing people because I also enjoyed that. And then we flash forward to, you know, sometime last year, a lot of life events happened. I became psychotic last year and purchased the house I was abused in. House, and it's a very cathartic experience, but that was my grandmother's house. So there's a lot of good memories as well as bad memories. It's a mixed bag. It was interesting. So I'm doing that and I'm sitting around and you kind of get that itch to like, I've always been teaching. I've been teaching this whole time, but you get the itch to like, I want my own school. And it was looking around. Well, I've got this new house that I'm renovating. I have a full-time job. I have all these other classes that I've kind of set up over the city where I teach disenfranchised people in different communities, and I teach at rehab facilities and stuff like that. And so it was like, I don't know that I have time to dedicate to open a school. And then it was like, but you know what? I probably could do a podcast. And I said, I probably could do a podcast. And then I want you to know the first three people that I thought of were three instructors that I had the fortune of studying with that are no longer with us. And those three instructors not being with us, I immediately said, I got to figure it out. I don't know what the answer is, but I got to figure it out. I did a very lackadaisical 3-second-ish search online. Hey, is there anybody else that's already doing this? Didn't find anything, because literally it was like martial arts conversation podcast search. Nope, nothing popped up. Okay. You know, like, didn't go to Spotify and search for martial arts podcast. Wasn't thinking about that. Was just thinking, oh, it must not exist. Google told me so just now, you know, in not even a scroll of the page. And so then it was like, okay, well, what do I use? Found Riverside, got a cheap mic, got set up, and just had the first conversation, because it was like this urgency had struck me, because, man, it would have been great to talk to Mike Whiting. It really would. And I miss him so much on a lot of different levels because of martial arts. Because he was that first instructor. At 10 years old, I take my $60 with my grandfather and I go in, and my grandfather fills out the paperwork and I get my uniform and I take my first class. And Mike was there. And Mike was not a very tall. I'm 6'5" for those that don't know. I am a large person. And when I was 10 years old, I was as tall as Mike Whiting. Mike Whiting was not a very tall man. I was also a tall 10-year-old. And what struck me as very interesting is that Mike had this very calm and kind demeanor, these nice, kind blue eyes, but had a firmness to him, where you knew you couldn't walk through him. You knew that, like, if it came down to it, you'd want him on your side. But he was just so kind and nice and would smile and make people laugh. And it's like the good balance that existed there, I wanted that. And I wanted that on my podcast. But, like, knowing that I couldn't get that made me want to start. And so it was like, from the cursory 3-second Google search, which told me there were no martial arts podcasts, to 1 week-ish of hitting record. Because I, you know, first of all, we're spoiled and Amazon can bring us the mics and all of that, you know. So yeah, I did that and I just started having the conversation. But what I told, the same thing I told the people that do Whistlekick, I'll tell you. Like, I went on Whistlekick and had a conversation with them, and I've had a couple of them on my podcast, is that I don't think that we can have too many of these conversations. I think that these conversations exist and need to exist to pay that debt to martial arts and to spread that word for existing students and new students. If I say something on this podcast that helps a victim, great. If I say something on this podcast that helps a dude who's been doing martial arts for 9 years and is starting to feel that mat fatigue, that rust, that ring rust, that, you know, maybe I'm done, maybe I've plateaued, maybe I've learned everything that I have. The guy that, like, life's getting too busy and he's thinking about dropping down from 2 days a week to 1 day every other week, and it inspires him to, like, no, this is really important. Then that's great. And the more little signals we send out into the world and the more different places, the more random ears we reach, the better we are at doing that. So I think all these podcasts are great. And I think, because that is who I am. You know, I am very spontaneous and get an idea and run with it. That's just who I am. And if I would have done a very in-depth research and found maybe your podcast or Whistlekick or a combination of any of the others that I'm not name dropping, I might have said, oh, well, I guess they got it covered, and then not done it. So it is my love letter to martial arts. It is my hoping to lift these voices up that I think are important. And it is my preserving this knowledge for future generations.
Very well said. No, I agree that there definitely is not there's room for all of us in the sure. The podcasting space. There are not too many shows. There are not too many people that are covering all of these different conversations, and mm-hmm. We have the Bill Wallaces that get interviewed right. a million times, and not to say I'm still working on trying to get him on the show, so
well, Bill Wallace is linked in some capacity with Whistlekick. A lot of the Whistlekick people have yeah, black belts yeah. under Bill Wallace. So maybe you should. I'll help you link with.
Yeah, them. Yeah. No, I'm actually tomorrow. I'm actually interviewing somebody that just got, I believe it was their fourth degree in Bill Wallace's system there. So, awesome. I have a few connections to him. So, try and squeeze him into the schedule. But we all have stories to share, and we all have different angles and different things, and we don't just all ask the same questions, or at least I certainly try not to ask all the same questions. Right. But there's definitely room for every all of these different shows to have these conversations and really be a record for these different stories and these different thoughts and things like that. Just kind of going back to the whole kind of Bruce Lee thing. So, I wish I had the little meme or picture or whatever, but, not too long ago, and I'm sure he's probably put it up a few times, but, Tom Bleeker, mm-hmm. well, very well known in the Kenpo world for mm-hmm. his many, many accomplishments. But he had posted something, and it was a picture of Bruce Lee, and it said something along the lines, I'm sorry, I'm going to misquote it, but it essentially said something along the lines of, oh, all these things you said that I said are not right, are not correct, or like I didn't say that. Mm-hmm. All these quotes that you connect to me, I never said. And so I think about that with the podcasting, is that getting this information directly from the people is important, so that we have this record. And so,
if Bruce 100 Lee was years still with us, he would be a podcaster.
Oh yeah, probably yeah. But 100 years from now, when somebody can say, oh well, this person said this thing, and it's like, well, did they? Oh well, let's go back to the Keep Kicking podcast, episode mm-hmm. 4002, and it's like, oh yeah, mm. they didn't say that. So I think it's important to have these stories and this information directly from the source. Mm-hmm. Definitely no shortage of shows and hosts that are willing to get out there and get on the mics to do that. So mm-hmm. important. So we are flying through our time here, but I want to make sure I want to get to one other thing before we head to our what I call the lightning round here, and okay. as we head towards wrapping up. So I've started asking my guest something. I was in part of a conversation about what it means to be a black belt, since there's among all the different styles, there is no rule set, there's no standard operating procedure about what makes a black belt, what defines a black belt, what is the characteristics of that. So, and of course there will never be a one standard for all of that, but I'm curious, what in your mind, what do you think makes someone a black belt, or what qualifies someone to be a black belt in your own thoughts?
I've got two answers for this. And the first answer is that I was told a long time ago, and I don't know the validity of it, and I don't really care the validity of it, because the symbolism of it is far more important. Someone said that the original belt system came from, in Tai Chi, instead of a belt, it's a sash, a little bit like thicker, holds more of your gut. And it's actually done for a purpose. And the purpose was not to display rank, but the purpose was to hold your gut in while you train so that you don't get a hernia. Similar to a weightlifting belt. That part is factual. I do know that to be factual. But the story that I was told was that you were given a very thick white sash. And as you train, sweat, dirt accumulates, it becomes yellow. You train some more sweat, dirt, maybe some blood. Now it looks kind of green. You just keep training, sweat, dirt. Now it's brown, very dark. Keep training, becomes black. Keep training. And eventually, the black belt that has been made and starts to exist, that black starts to chip off and peel away to just reveal another layer of white underneath. So that's one of my answers. But the other answer is very similar. What is a black belt? A black belt should embody what the white belt should have embodied when they came through the door. And most Kenpo practitioners have some form of attribute that goes along with every belt level. In the Kenpo school that I was a part of, white belt was effort. And it went effort, adaptability, self-control, focus, knowledge, quickness, sincerity, durability, discipline, and empathy. And by the time we get to black belt and we get to empathy, effort is what we should have. You know? So we should be showing that effort, because the martial arts will give us far more than we can ever give the martial arts. We should at least give it the time that it deserves. So for me, black belt's the beginning, not the end.
I like it. Well said.
Thank you.
All right, so we are going to move into our lightning round here. I got a few questions as we head towards wrapping up. So okay. The first question being, do you have a favorite technique?
A favorite technique? Just one?
Ugh. Yeah, I know. This is a difficult one, especially for Kenpo people, but
it
doesn't have to
kick.
Be just one. Oh.
Inverted roundhouse kick.
Inverted roundhouse kick. All right.
Well, nice. I said I like earlier, it. I'm 6'5", so like, I'm 6'5", I weigh 210. I'm kind of just a wiry dude. Crane flows great for me, so anything crane would be like my number two answer. I typically fight crane, but I've landed more inverted roundhouse kicks than I have landed anything else, you know? And that is like bouncing, worked at a juvenile jail for a little bit, just out in the streets, being very rambunctious, late teen, early 20s, to every time I spar. And it's because I'm long and lanky and it can just sneak up through. So, inverted roundhouse kick.
Very nice. Very nice. Good answer. All right. Next one. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Five pinon is the favorite. If I had to get number two, might be the Statue of the Crane. I don't know if you have that one or not, but
I will do my homework and learn about that one. Very nice, very nice. I like it. All right, next question: do you have a favorite weapon?
In the school that I was a part of, we had to do a weapon thesis, you know, and I picked an ink pen.
Very nice.
So an ink pen is probably my answer.
How very John Wick of you.
Traditional weapon would probably be either bow staff or sai. I've had to have bow staff custom made because I snap them quite easy doing slams. So I had to have them made out of Cocoboa. They were very expensive, but they don't break.
Very nice. I like it. Yeah, no, staff is one of my It's probably my favorite, yeah. So I like it. I like it. All right. Next question. If there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, since this is a Kenpo show, who would that be?
I'm going to give you a really obscure answer.
Ooh, I like it.
Because I don't have an actual person's name, but the very first documented martial art that is considered to be mixed martial arts is an art that is called Ningjungkyun. Okay? It is a Chinese art that happens at the lowest part of China that is closest to Japan. And what happened is all of the fishermen along that coastline worked with fishermen from Japan who came up via boat, and they just traded back and forth their knowledge. And that's the first documented, you know, mixed martial art. And I would love to just be on that beach for 17 years, you know, like, oh, yeah, just there. So that's the answer.
Very nice.
Or like Bruce Lee, because everybody says that, right?
you know, I kind of expected a lot of people to say Bruce Lee, and he doesn't come up that actually. I'll have to go back through the records, but he is not mentioned as much as I would have expected. Okay. So
that's good. That's good.
Yeah, no, I like that. So internet people, you know, you can come after me, but me personally, I'm going to say that I think Bruce Lee is a little overrated. Of course his influence on the martial arts is undeniable. There's all right. So with my seamless editing, no one will know that we had some technical issues, but we're gonna jump right back in. Not totally sure exactly where the issue started, but I was in the middle of saying something controversial. Maybe this
about
is why
Bruce Lee.
Maybe this is why we had technical difficulties. But like it or not, internet, I said it. I think that Bruce Lee is a little overrated, not because of his technical skills. I mean, his influence on the martial arts is undeniable. There are very few. It would be hard to argue that there are many other people in history that have had such a profound effect on the martial arts as Bruce Lee. I mean,
absolutely.
Just about anybody you talk to these days, or in the last, I don't know, let's say 25 years, would say that Bruce Lee was an inspiration for them getting involved in martial arts or anything sure. related. But I say he's kind of overrated for one. I'm of the mind a lot of the things that say a lot of the things that he's kind of known for, or I guess I don't know, theories, principles and things that he's come up with, I'm willing to argue. All right. So what is this? Take three. So once again, for the listeners, through my seamless editing, you won't know a thing has happened, but we are back at it again. And we were talking about Bruce Lee. So maybe there is some sort of conspiracy or something going on, because every time I seem to talk about it, we have technical problems and things get messed up. But we're going to try this again. And I was saying that I believe that a lot of the principles and theories and things that Bruce Lee is attributed to, I'm not saying he stole or anything like that, but I think a lot of his way of thinking was heavily influenced by Ed Parker. A lot of the things that he started saying and professing about how, you know, martial arts should be, or you know, how the style should develop or whatever, are very he was kind of coined a lot of these things that he said at the same time that he was hanging out with Ed Parker, and Ed Parker was you know, trying to get him on the scene. So I think a lot of Bruce Lee's things maybe not directly came from Kenpo and from Ed Parker, but I definitely think a lot of it was guided by his time with Ed Parker. So
sure, but I'll challenge your thought with a thought experiment. As a martial artist, how much of our of what we teach, of what we pass on, is ours?
Yeah, no.
You know? I mean, I own very little of it. And I mean, philosophically, I own that which surrounds my trauma, you know, and even people that are not traumatized, they own philosophically that which involves their journey. But the stuff that involves the technique or the way the technique should be taught is probably stuff that we don't realize we got from another instructor somewhere else. So, like, sure, there is validity to what you're saying, but it might not be conceptually what you think it is.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I mean, even with Ed Parker, I don't believe that, you know, he was definitely ahead of his time, and he definitely came up with a lot of things, but sure, obviously not everything that he is known for and came up were all his own, you know, quote unquote original ideas or anything like that. So yeah, of course we've been on, you know, humans have been on the planet for however many years, and yeah, we're, you know, here we are in the, I don't know, 21st century, the things that we're coming up with in the last few years are of course not new, completely new original thoughts and all of that. Mm-hmm. So, I think that there is, I don't know. No, I don't want to take Bruce Lee off of any kind of pedestal or anything like that.
And he
would definitely, you know, beat my butt. Yeah, even now in his current state, I'm sure he could probably take me. But
he had the ability to shut down a podcast two times over.
yeah. From the grave, he's managing to silence me. So I don't know. I think he maybe gets, I don't want to say that he gets more credit than he deserves, but I don't think it's just all him. I think there's a lot of other sources.
That's very much fair. That's very much fair. That's why I'm on my podcast, I don't necessarily seek out those large names. You know, like, it would be great to have a conversation with Superfoot Wallace, or I don't know if you know who Chris Crudelli is. He's a famous martial artist from the United Kingdom. It'd be great to have a conversation with him, or some of the other, like, martial artists that are really kind of big names that I happen to know or be associated with. It'd be wonderful to have conversations with them, but those conversations already exist, and a conversation with somebody that taught me that nobody really knows worldwide, those are more important to me. Or, like, just most of my conversations that I've had on my podcast are, I have an agnosium of martial arts friends that I know on Facebook that I've never met in real life, and just cold sending a message and being like, hey, you want to have a martial arts conversation? You know, that's been the majority of it. It's just expanding the community and not expanding it in ways that it's already expounded, so to speak. So I give you that he is not an end-all be-all to martial arts, for sure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. All right, so let me see. We have one more question in our lightning round here. I'm still working on how I'm trying to work this question, but I will go ahead and put it in this way. So, what is something that either motivates you to train, or I should say, and or what is something that you would want to put out there as a motivation for someone else to train? So I have previously framed this in the view of the movie Rocky IV. So whenever I watch the movie Rocky IV and we get to the training montage, he's running in the snow, the music's playing, he's chopping the wood, all that good stuff, lifting the rocks. I see that scene and I'm ready to get out on the mats, get into the studio and get to work. So I'm curious if there is something like that for you and something that you would want to put out there that is motivational for people to get out and train.
Okay. So first, I think that motivation is something that we as humans seek, but is fake. I think that it is a muscle that exists within us and that we can exercise it. And some people have a stronger muscle than others, but I don't think it's necessarily something that you can give somebody. I do think that you can say to every martial arts student, it will get better if you keep working it. And the it is interchangeable with whatever you need it to be. It could be the bad feeling that exists inside, or it could be as simple as your sidekick. It will get better if you keep working it. If you keep working it, the inside will get better. If you keep working it, the kick will get better.
I like it. All right. So now we are at our final portion of our episode today. And that is the point of shameless self-promotion. So you can plug anything that you want. Plug anything that you want, or if there's anything else that you wanted to get out there that maybe we didn't cover that you wanted to make sure we get out for our time today, you now have the floor. You can say whatever you like, and then we'll officially close out from there.
Okay, I guess I'll just say Keep Kicking Podcast is on YouTube and it's on Spotify. I'd love for people to listen and hopefully get something out of it. If you're a martial artist, my email is keepkickingpod@gmail.com. Have a conversation with me, whether it be good or bad. If you watch two of my podcasts and I piss you off because I said something that you don't agree with, let's have that discord and maybe we can come to a mutual understanding. I don't mind if somebody disagrees with me. I mind if they're just like, that's wrong and won't give me a reason why, because I can't learn from that. I can't grow from that. And you as a person saying that I'm wrong, you can't learn and grow from that. But that's it. I'm not doing this for money. There's no money in podcasting unless you're Joe Rogan. I'm just doing it for the love and for the conversation, for the discord. So this was great. Thanks for having me on, man.
Yes, thank you so much for taking the time to share your story. Like I say with all mm-hmm. of my guests, we'll definitely have to do a part 2 and 3 and 4 and 25. And so you
absolutely
have an open invitation to be on anytime. I could talk to people for hours and hours on end, but mm-hmm. we don't have time for that. And I actually have to mm-hmm. go back to my day job today. So, yeah,
that's unfortunate. Those are the worst. They drag us down.
Yeah, no, especially being this week, everybody's checked out. So, but
that's right.
You know, we do what we got to do. I gotta pay for this podcasting empire that I have. That's taking all my money. Right. But yes, once again, I thank you so much for being on and sharing your story, and I can't wait mm-hmm. for everyone to hear this. And yeah, we will close out for today. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.